quickly. It would be many years before George finally learned the extent to which he had been bamboozled by his manager, and by then it cost him about $30 million. "Somebody should have warned me," he said. "Oh, that's right, you did." By then, George hated Dennis so much that he wrote and recorded a song called Lyin' O'Brien. A few months after the bowl, the rest of the Pythons decided that they too had had enough of him, and we all assembled for a conference at the Chewton Glen Hotel to decide how to tell him he was fired. Chapter 16, The Meaning of Wife. There is only one edition of Playboy magazine from the 70s that does not have a full nude on the cover. It features the beautiful derriere of a lovely lady in blue cut-off jeans on a bicycle seat. It is an unforgettable image, and it became iconic. The curve of her body, the elliptical perfection of those cheeks, the delicious delight of her golden globes. Reader, I married that lady. Tanya appeared on the cover of the September 1974 edition, and oddly, I too appeared in Playboy in the November 1976 edition. Only I would be naked. They reprinted an excerpt from my Rutland Dirty Weekend book, The Vatican Sex Manual, which shows you 64 positions in which it is impossible to have sex. I proposed to Tanya after the Hollywood Bowl show in 1980, and high time too. I suddenly realized that I'd been with her for 4 years, and what the hell was I waiting for? Being a gentleman, I gave her till morning to consider my proposal. Luckily for me, she said yes. Tanya was the woman I had been waiting for my whole life, and I have been waiting for her ever since. I wrote on my graffiti wall at 41 Carlton Hill in the 70s, "Time and tide wait for no man, but they do seem to make an exception for certain women." This must, of course, be amended to people for our more correct times, because, of course, it is true of all sexes. I have been with Tanya for 41 years now. I gave that woman 2 of the best years of my life. Tanya was not only beautiful, but very funny. She once asked me what I was reading, and when I said The Shorter Peeps, she asked me if there was a taller one. She could always crack me up. On her Twitter feed, she describes herself as a gagster's moll. She once entered England and wrote under occupation, pillow. In Sydney, she asked me what Australia Day was. I said it's when Australians get together and drink. Oh, she said, like night time. Comedy was as vital to her as to me. Most of her friends were in comedy, particularly the Chicago Improv Theatre Second City. And she became friends with John Belushi, Dan Aykroyd, Joe Flaherty, and Brian Doyle Murray. She looked them up when she moved to New York, where Saturday Night Live was suddenly blossoming. This would bring us together. I was fortunate that from the minute we met, I inherited from Tanya a large, loving family of American relatives. She grew up in the western suburbs of Chicago with her sister Joyce and 2 brothers, Mark, a cop, who I saw box in the Golden Gloves, and Greg, a drummer, who sold cars. There were 3 adorable nieces, Chris, Kim, and Sasha, and a whole slew of aunts and uncles. At Thanksgiving, there would be more than 30 sitting down for dinner. Tanya's mother, Algie, for whom I could do no wrong, was second-generation Italian, from Napoli, and her father, Alex, was a Russian who had escaped from the Soviet Union in 1929 when the border changed overnight and it became Poland for a day. Alexander Kosovich drove a Chicago taxi for most of his life, loved vodka and laughter and rescuing animals, and had a heart of gold. He played the accordion while his girls would dance the troika. He spent weeks bundling off packages of jeans to all the poor Russian relatives who lived near Kiev. Amazingly, he still thought Stalin was a good thing, which led to many heated arguments with me. Now I was surrounded by this whole argumentative, laughing, loving bunch of kin, who were perfectly prepared to accept that Tanya had taken on this weird Brit. I was a very lucky bastard. We were married in May 1981 in Susan and Lorne Michaels' apartment in New York, with a party upstairs at Paul Simon's. All the relatives came. We were married by a New York judge who brought her own vows. We both promised to listen to each other's silences. Chapter 17. Cinema, Half Sin, Half Enema. Before we fired him, Dennis O'Brien had told John Cleese that after Life of Brian, if we made another movie, he would never have to work again. This persuaded John to join us in writing what was then called Monty Python's Fish Film. The problem was we had no theme. For a while we worked on World War III, which was sponsored by advertisers, and then it became about a party of explorers in the Hindu Kush. While we attempted to bring some sense to a bunch of disparate sketches, Gilliam would sit doodling, pinning up images on a corkboard. One of his sketches was particularly memorable. It was a familiar sight, a typical London office draped with the canvas they use when washing buildings, except that it was billowing like a sail. It looked as if the building was just getting underway, and it was ripping out a huge anchor from the pavement. This image would form the basis of his Crimson Pearl Assurance, the short film that would open our next movie, if we ever got to make it, which was looking increasingly unlikely. We were getting nowhere. We decided to go to the West Indies again for inspiration, this time choosing Jamaica. We spent a frustrating 2 weeks in a very pleasant house in St. Anne's Bay near Ocho Rios. But we were no closer to having a movie. It was still just a pile of sketches. No plot, no through line, no consistent characters. We were on the point of abandoning the whole business and just having a holiday when towards the end of our stay, I came down to breakfast with an idea. I've been thinking that what this really could be all about is the meaning of life. They loved that idea. Even John, who later said it was particularly annoying as he had been looking forward to the vacation. We set to work in the short time left to us, chopping, changing and shaping our material to this theme. We'd taken some time off to explore the beauties of the island, and I spent a wonderful day with Terry Gilliam looking at Firefly, Noel Coward's delightful little house with its fantastic view of the sea, and Ian Fleming's Goldeneye. I didn't know then that I would play Noel Coward in the movie, and that the penis song would be called the Not the Noel Coward song. We moved on to Port Antonio, where we took an amazing river ride on a log raft down the Rio Grande, poled by a highly skilled young Jamaican, amongst some of the lushest and most perfect scenery I have ever seen. As we floated gently through this paradise, Terry would not stop moaning about Dennis O'Brien, for whom he had also made Time Bandits. He went on and on until I finally said, "Terry, for God's sake, shut up and just look where you are. We can talk later." When we got back to the house, we had a business meeting. Dennis O'Brien owed us $1 million from the Hollywood Bowl movie. What on earth were we going to do to pry it out of him? "Why don't we seize his yacht?" I said. "We're in the Caribbean. It's moored not far away. We should just go and sail it off. He's not going to tell anyone that Monty Python has taken his yacht. He'll look like a total prat. We'll thank him for lending it to us and let him know that as soon as he pays us our money, he can have his boat back." To my surprise, everyone thought this was a great idea. They all voted in favour of it, except John. "No," he said, "we can't." "Why not?" "It's piracy," he said. That's the trouble with being trained as a lawyer. They know these minor little details about theft and piracy. I'm proud to say Monty Python voted 5 out of 6 to become pirates. But the Python veto rule held. Everyone had the right to veto a vote. A surprisingly effective and fair rule, which meant that no one could be forced into doing what they didn't want to do. But for that, Dennis O'Brien would have sold off our TV series, for which we'd still be paying him 20%. I dragged my heels. When we all came back a few months later, everyone had changed their minds. No wonder he hated me. We returned to London with a theme and a title, but no plot. I thought the screenplay still needed work, but John was reluctant to have any more writing meetings. I've always felt that was a pity, as it seems to me it could have used one more draft. It was really only a sketch film, tenuously held together by a concept. It occurred to me later that we could easily have made it as The Seven Ages of Man, about the same central character growing from birth to death, but darting backwards and forwards in time, so that his birth is in one era, his child in another, and so on, but not in any historical order. I still think that might have been a good idea, but then hindsight is always perfect. I may have come up with this thought when I was working with John Dupre to adapt it as a Broadway musical. The trouble was it already was a musical, but as an idea for the stage it was disastrous, as it had no common characters and no plot. It's a review. The Meaning of Life was shot in 1982 at Elstree Studios and in Scotland, where the Zulu warriors went on strike. Despite that, it was a fairly happy experience. Because we needed $10 million, we had sold the movie to Tom Mount at Universal. We refused to let him see the screenplay and simply gave him a budget and a short poem I wrote. There's everything in this movie, everything that fits, from the meaning of life in the universe to girls with great big tits. We've got movie stars and foreign cars, explosions and the lot, filmed as only we know how on the budget that we've got. We spent a fortune on locations and quite a bit on drink, and there's even the odd philosophical joke just to make you buggers think. Yet some parts are as serious and as deep as you could wish, but largely it's all tits and arse and quite a lot of fish. Other bits are childish and some parts frankly rude, but at least we've got a lot of nice girls all banging around in the nude. So take your seats, enjoy yourselves, and let's just hope it's funny, because it's not only done to make you laugh, but to make us lots of money. Yes, sit back and have a good time with your boyfriend or your wife. Relax and just enjoy yourselves, for this is the meaning of life. Amazingly, Universal said yes to this. Many years later, when I met Tom Mount again, I said, what a brave punt I thought that was, and he said, not at all. Because he had greenlit our movie, many American comedians who were huge Python fans, amongst them Richard Pryor, beat a path to his door, and he made several very successful comedies. Ours was apparently not among them, because although it cost only $10 million and took in $25 million, the studio assured us for many years that it was still not yet in profit, even after the video release. Finally, in the 90s, when I'd learned the Hollywood game a bit better, John Goldstone, our producer, came to me and said that Universal was requesting permission to release it as a DVD. And since these had not been invented when we made the movie, they didn't have those rights. Tell them no, I said. We're still not yet in profit. Miraculously, the next day, the movie was in profit. Like God, the studios move in mysterious ways. The film contains many great things, including Every Sperm is Sacred, wonderfully choreographed by Arlene Phillips and magnificently shot by Terry Jones. I always regret I was in Australia when the final editing decisions were taken and they removed my blonde French cooking lady, who I thought was funny. Still, there were the Galaxy Song, the Penis Song, Christmas in Heaven, and I'm fond of our title track, The Meaning of Life, which I sang in a Charles Aznavour voice. John Dupre and I were really getting into our stride composing songs, and the Galaxy Song is still one of my favourites. Terry Gilliam took his sketch of the office building under sale and turned it into a movie about rogue accountants, complete with our accountancy shanty. It's fun to charter an accountant. The Crimson Pearl Assurance was originally supposed to be a short 6-minute insert towards the end of our movie, but no one has ever found it easy to stop Terry Gilliam filming. And he took over a whole soundstage next door and kept on shooting till he ended up with an 18-minute film about old accountants threatened by takeovers who declare war on the city and set sail for adventure. It's wonderful, but of course was far too long when we tried it in the main body of the film. Instead, we decided to put this Gilliam sequence before The Meaning of Life. At the Cannes Film Festival in 1983, it surprised and delighted the stuffy French cinephiles at our screening. And I'm convinced the brilliance of it persuaded the Cannes jury to award us the jury prize, although Orson Welles was on the panel, and he must have loved Mr. Creosote. For our press conference, as a send-up of Cannes, we had the bright idea of posing for the photographers on the beach exposing our nipples, a gag which was immediately ruined when a French starlet walked topless behind the rows of assembled cameramen, and they all took off in pursuit of her. Terry Jones then shocked the festival by announcing that we were certainly going to win, because we had bribed the jury. They trumped his gag by awarding us their jury prize. At the closing awards ceremony, Terry went one better when he accepted the prize and announced that the jury would find their bribe money taped behind the plumbing in the gents' toilet. You've got to love Terry. I have often found that bad movies are much more fun to be on than good ones. This was certainly true of Yellowbeard, written by Graham Chapman, Bernard McKenna, and Peter Cook. In those days, executives seemed to feel that if you could lure one or two pythons into a project, the audience would think it was a python film. It never worked. What they failed to notice is that it's the writing in Python that makes the difference, and it takes all of us. Graham was very sweet to me now that he was sober, and said that if John and I agreed to be in his pirate film, he would get a green light. I agreed to do it if they would shoot my part in 3 weeks, so I wouldn't have to stay on location kicking my heels for months. John agreed to an even shorter time constraint, which meant he wouldn't even have to go to Mexico. The good news was that Marty was going to be in it, although when he came into our London kitchen, gaunt and chain-smoking, Tanya and I were shocked by his appearance. He was emaciated, though very happy to be back in the UK working with all his old pals again. It was like old times, returning to his homeland after a long and successful career in Hollywood. Well, it was certainly successful at the beginning, when he worked with Mel Brooks on Young Frankenstein and Silent Movie. But when he began to write, star, and direct his own films, he had several flops. Hollywood thinks that failure is somehow contagious, and when he threw a party, nobody showed up. Yes, it can be that cruel. Anyway, it was fun for him to come home and hang out with Peter and Graham and John and me. We had a delightful week filming in Rye before we flew to our location in Mexico, where customs immediately impounded all our costumes until the right amount of money found its way into the right hands. The movie had attracted a stellar cast of funny actors. Spike Milligan, Peter Boyle, Madeline Kahn, Kenneth Mars, Peter Bull, Cheech and Chong, James Mason, and Michael Horden, whom Peter Cook dubbed Horden Monster, after he complained loudly and bitterly at the hotel's front desk for shrinking his laundry. The whole lobby watched in fascination. Peter said it was a better performance than his King Lear. Unfortunately, as we often say about Hollywood, the studio had chosen a newcomer to direct, a pleasant man whose previous experience was working as a sports director for American TV. Who knows what they were thinking, but Mel Damski seemed certainly out of his comfort zone directing comedy. The comedians were flown in serially, so at no stage was there a general read-through for everyone to get on the same page about the style of comedy we were playing. Yellowbeard was not a success, but the making-of documentary, Group Madness, is quite fun. Peter Cook was in great form, and as with all films, we had acres of time on our hands to spend hanging around in the pool at our luxury hotel. Peter would spend the day bobbing up and down in the water, improvising in that peculiar nasal E.L. Wistey voice.
The funny thing about the universe is we know where the light comes from, but where does the darkness come from? The speed of light is 300,000 kilometres a second. But what is the speed of darkness?
He'd given up drinking, and one evening he suggested we needed to find some grass. I agreed to accompany him, but where to look? No problem, said Peter. We shall find the nearest bordello. My wife gave me an old-fashioned look, which Peter noticed, reassuring her with his incredible charm that I should come to no harm. Somewhat sceptically, she agreed to let me go. So off we drove to the local Mexican brothel. It wasn't far. A small door in a white-walled street led into a cantina, a square open to the sky with a band and a bar and lovely girls who were happy to dance, or there was a low cabana to the side with discreet rooms if you wished to dance horizontally. There were tables for drinking and strings of coloured lights, and when we entered it had the air of a private party where the guests had yet to arrive. Peter was an instant hit. He ran in shouting loudly in cod Spanish, shook the hand of the barman, seized a beautiful tall girl in a shiny red bathing suit, and stormed onto the deserted dance floor, where he began the most unimaginable shaking jitterbug. The girls went nuts. They danced around him, and he boogied with them all, flinging his arms around, his hair wild, occasionally sinking to his knees, or exaggeratedly twisting low. One minute it was a slow night in a naughty nightclub, and the next it was a one-man fiesta. The whole place loved Peter, The band became animated, the barman grinned as he shook his cocktails, people flocked in to watch, and every girl was mad to dance with this wild, crazy Englishman, who radiated goodwill and, yes, damn it, innocence. It went on for hours, with the band going nuts and the girls lining up to fandango with this wild spirit. We were filming the next day, and as midnight approached, I made my excuses and slipped away. My beautiful young wife was waiting at the hotel. It would be hard enough to persuade her we only went to score some grass without staying all night. My last sight was Peter leading a line of ecstatic ladies in a conga line. He waved cheerily, tapped his nose and yelled, "No problem, Eric, we're in." In the morning, we learned what had happened. Peter had taken the tall girl in the red bathing suit back to her room. Once inside, he asked casually if she had any grass. "Of course," she said, reached under the bed and brought out a huge load wrapped in newspaper. Peter asked her how much for it. She cited a derisory amount, and the deal was made. "I have to go now," said Peter. "What?" She broke into tears. How could he possibly leave? Didn't he think she was beautiful? She was utterly distraught. "I only wanted some grass," Peter explained as gently as he could. But she was inconsolable. It wasn't a matter of money. It was her honour. It was Mexico. It was her reputation. Poor Peter tried hard to convince her that, honestly, she was really beautiful, and normally he would have been torn up with desire for her, but he'd only come for a dance and some grass. He had, he said, to spend a long time reassuring her. "Been easier to shag her," said Marty, getting to the nub. This would be Marty's last film, and he's very funny in it. He died on his final day in Mexico City, when he had a heart attack in the hotel, and the traffic was so horrendous the ambulance couldn't make it in time. He would have lived had he been in L.A. He was only 48. It would also be Graham's final film. Chapter 18, Brightside Returns. Always look on the bright side of life has probably been my subconscious motto throughout my life, but I never thought it would be a hit, and not just in the top 10 charts. On January the 20th, 2009, it officially became the number one most requested song at British funerals, replacing Frank Sinatra's My Way. It has remained there ever since, beating out even Elvis. You've got to love the Brits. First of all, who would even have such a chart? And secondly, of course you don't get paid for funerals, but hey, you take it where you can. It probably replaced Spam, Spam, Spam at Viking funerals. As far as I was concerned, Brightside was just the end song of a movie, but now it began to take on a life of its own. It began at Graham's memorial. I was asked to sing it to close the event, as it was Graham's favourite song, and it was one of the hardest things I've ever had to do. I was still singing it to Graham, but now for the final time. He had died, with exquisite timing, on October the 4th, 1989, the eve of Monty Python's 20th anniversary. We cancelled a huge party we had planned, which wouldn't have been what he wanted, but it was how we felt. It was a shock. This was one of us. Mike and Terry J were with him at the end. John wept inconsolably. I was at home writing a song for him, "Life Will Get You in the End." I finally finished it when George died. A month before he died, Graham joined us filming Parrot Sketch Not Included, 20 Years of Monty Python, a 72-minute celebration hosted by Steve Martin. I can still remember Steve's shocked look of horror as he watched an emaciated Graham being carried in. Nobody had warned him. Graham had lost a lot of weight after two operations on his cancer, but he was his usual cheery self, cracking jokes about his condition. And we all did a sketch together with Steve interviewing us as school kids. We did another shot where Steve asked to camera where all the pythons were today, and then opened a closet. We were inside. It would be the last time we were all together. One final gag, and after it, we took one final photo. I had bumped into Graham at the Beverly Center in L.A. that January, and he had a big wide grin and looked hale and hearty and said he had a slight thing in his throat, nothing to worry about, but he was going back to London for a procedure. When I visited him at Cromwell Hospital after his second operation, he looked in a very bad way. But he surprised me when he told me he was thinking of opening a longevity centre. Perhaps he was joking. Maybe he was trying to cheer me up. Who knows? But it would be the last time I saw him. On December the 3rd, 1989, we all gathered in the packed Great Hall at St. Bartholomew's Hospital for his memorial, where I had to sing Always Look on the Bright Side of Life. It was particularly hard to get through, and I almost lost it. It was even harder because, thanks to John Cleese, the memorial had become a roast. He brilliantly broke the somber mood and turned solemn grief into relieving laughter with an outrageous parody of their dead parrot sketch. Graham Chapman is no more. He has ceased to be. Bereft of life, he rests in peace. He has rung down the curtain and joined the choir invisible. And I say, good riddance to him, the freeloading bastard. I hope he fries. And I say that because if I hadn't said something inappropriate, he would never have forgiven me. It was one of John's finest moments. It was inspired. It was fantastic. And he concluded by saying he would like to be the first to say fuck at a British memorial. From that point on, the afternoon became uproarious. Michael spoke about how Graham was always late, and whenever he had to pick him up for rehearsal, various heads popped out of windows saying Graham would be down in about 20 minutes. Michael would sit fuming in his car for 20 minutes until finally Graham would emerge for work. Michael ended his eulogy by saying, I'm not very sentimental, but as I look around at all these great people, I like to think that Graham is here with us all today. Well, not now, but in about 20 minutes. How ironic that Graham, who was always late, left so early. That really should have been it for the song, except that it wasn't. Bizarrely, it was about to become a popular hit. I had become friendly with a neighbour, Gary Lineker, a brilliant footballer, the captain of England and Spurs, and now the presenter of BBC's Match of the Day. One day in 1991, Gary said to me, "You know they're singing your song on the terraces." Apparently, football fans had taken to singing it when their sides were losing helplessly. All boys took on the bright side of life. Da-da, 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 da-da. Simon Mayo, a friend of Gary's and a BBC Radio 1 DJ, began playing the song every morning on his breakfast show, so it was getting a lot of airplay. Because of this, Virgin Records re-released it as a single on September the 23rd, 1991. And to my surprise, it began to rise up the pop charts. It was strangely exciting, as each week it rose higher and higher. It eventually got to number 3, where it peaked after I had been persuaded to sing it on Top of the Pops, a deliberately chaotic performance with John Dupre leading the band. Simon Mayo said it was because I had sung it on Top of the Pops, and he may well have been right, but it did get to number 1 on the ITV charts, and even more satisfying, it became number 1 in Ireland, which was great because the movie had been banned there, and the soundtrack album on Warner's was withdrawn and pulled out of record stores after protest when it was first released. A fitting revenge. Because it was such a hit, ITV asked me to sing it for the Queen on the Royal Variety Performance, an annual charity event held that year at the Victoria Palace Theatre. I'd grown up watching this show, which featured every top artist and the best comedians from Britain and America. Even the Beatles had been on it. And John Lennon had said cheekily, "The people in the cheaper seats, clap your hands, and the rest of you, if we just rattle your jewellery." Tommy Cooper, a wonderfully funny British comedian, had died on it, collapsing backwards through the curtains at the end of his set to a huge laugh. Everyone thought he was joking. Shockingly, he was dead. A great way to go, though. So, of course, I said yes. Traditionally, on the show, there was a classical moment from the opera or ballet where the audience would nod off for a bit. I decided to use this to play a gag on them. David Frost introduced Anne Howard, my singer friend from the English National Opera, in an aria from Madame Butterfly, and the curtain rose to reveal a beautiful set with a little Japanese bridge on which stood Lieutenant Pinkerton in his naval whites.
Anne was dressed in a kimono with a black wig and knitting needles in her hair, and at her feet was a Japanese maid lying prostrate in a kowtow. She began the famous aria.
One fine day we'll notice.
I could feel the posh audience sinking down in their seats, beginning to take a nap. After a minute or two, Anne pulled out a Japanese sword to kill herself. At her feet, the little Japanese maid raised up. Stop, I said, for I was playing the maid. Some things in life are bad. They can really make you mad. The audience went nuts. They laughed themselves silly. Nobody'd seen this coming. I could see the Queen in the royal box laughing out loud. And always look on the bright side of life. Anne Howard watched in stunned amazement as six sumo wrestlers came on whistling. I pulled off my kimono to reveal an English football kit, and we began to fill the stage with some of the classic acts I remembered from when I was a kid. The Tiller Girls, the British Rockettes, high-kicking across the front of the stage, followed by the Dagenham Girl Pipers playing their bagpipes. "Why the Dagenham Girl Pipers?" Prince Philip said to me afterwards, still giggling. "Because no Royal Variety performance would be complete without the Dagenham Girl Pipers," I replied. We ended up with dancing men in top hats and tails, a full Welsh choir and a British regimental band playing along loudly. Then I led the whole ensemble off stage and exited through the centre of the stalls, with the audience clapping and singing along. It was a lovely moment, and the gag worked even better than I had imagined. John Dupre, of course, conducted and arranged the whole thing. Afterwards, the Queen was still laughing when I was introduced to her. And what made it even better was that behind her was Lord Delfont, who had cancelled the life of Brian. "I told them, Bernie," I said, "they'll never make their money back." Chapter 19, The Quest for a Musical. When I was young, I was taken to see D'Oyly Carte Opera Company in productions of Gilbert and Sullivan. When he died, Pop left me full recordings on ancient 78s of my two favourites, The Mikado and The Pirates of Penzance. As a teenager, I had seen performances of both at the Royal Shakespeare Theatre in Stratford-upon-Avon. And now it occurred to me that Pirates would make a very good musical film. We ostensibly had a film company, so I stayed on in Tunisia after the end of shooting Brian to put the finishing touches to a Victorian screenplay, which opened at the Victoria and Albert Museum in modern-day London, where workmen stumble across a vault filled with cans of Victorian film. This turns out to be the first film ever made. I like the idea of the first ever movie being a Victorian musical, and it would all be shot like Pre-Raphaelite paintings on location in genuine Victorian settings. After the modern-day documentary opening, we cut to the gala opening in front of Queen Victoria in a crowded Royal Opera House, the boxes packed with Victorian celebrities like W.S. Gilbert and Oscar Wilde. There's a big steam-operated film projector at the back of the auditorium, with a grimy stoker shoveling coal into its furnace. Sir Arthur Sullivan himself is conducting the overture, and when the curtain rises, it reveals not a stage, but a movie screen with a sailing ship at sea and pirates singing and dancing on deck. My assistant Christine Miller and I scoured Cornwall and Devon for the perfect settings. We found our pirate ship in Torbay, and I got permission from Lord St. Leven, who owned St. Michael's Mount, opposite Penzance, to film there. My aim was to open the movie on the 100th anniversary of the operetta opening on Broadway, where it first ran before London. This was to establish copyright in America, to avoid the piracy Gilbert and Sullivan had suffered from HMS Pinafore. At one point, there were 7 productions of Pinafore on Broadway, none of which paid a penny in royalties. They rehearsed The Pirates of Penzance in the UK, gave one performance in Torquay to establish copyright, and then rushed the entire cast over by boat to open on Broadway, where it was a smash hit. I believe those are the roots of musical theatre in New York. I had become friendly with some cavalry officers of the Queen's Troop, a brigade of hussars garrisoned in St. John's Wood. After visiting their barracks and discovering there were Python fans and loved Gilbert and Sullivan, I gained permission to film them bringing their horse-drawn Victorian field guns into action in Hyde Park, firing off a 21-gun salute for the Queen's birthday. Better yet, they gave me permission to take a camera crew onto the Victoria Memorial, an ornate edifice on a traffic island directly in front of Buckingham Palace. Here I could get an unbelievable shot of the entire British Army marching down the Mall. Now, the British Army in full-dress uniform is not all that different from a century before, so all I had to do was to avoid shooting anything that was not in period, and I would have the most superb footage. I could shoot any part of this event, with the single exception of the Queen and the Duke of Edinburgh, sitting on their horses taking the salute. Everything else would be perfect. So, there I was on the Victoria Memorial, with my shoulder-length hair, baseball cap, tank tops, shorts and a tiny crew. It was a blazing June day as we shot rank after rank of the British Army advancing directly down the Mall, in widescreen. In their red coats and their bearskins, the flanks of their horses gleaming, their brasses glinting, their sabres drawn, their bright breastplates flashing in the summer sunlight, it was a million-dollar shot. As the front ranks wheeled around us, we scrambled to the Buckingham Palace side of the monument to catch them marching directly in front of us. I directed my cameramen to close in on the horses' hooves, the glistening buckles, the glinting helmets, the gleaming swords, all tight shots I could use later. I was running around enthusiastically pointing and jumping about with glee when I became aware I was being watched. Two pairs of gimlet eyes were staring at me, the Queen's and the Duke of Edinburgh's. They were both on horseback, and they had become riveted by our activity. You have to understand that this was their show. The eyes of the entire world were on them. Thousands of people had turned out to see them, lining the streets of London for hours. TV cameras were broadcasting their image live round the world, while this loony ran around directly in front of them, not 15 yards away, totally ignoring them. What was he doing? It must have seemed incomprehensible to them. Not once did I even turn my camera in their direction. They were the stars of the show, and I was shooting the extras. They stared at me in mute incomprehension, this hippie ragamuffin right on their patch outside the gates of their palace, deliberately ignoring them. What was going on? What the hell was I doing? I could feel their eyes boring into me. I stopped and turned to look at them. I was watching the Queen watching me, her hand raised to her hat in salute, the Duke next to her in utter disbelief. They stared at me while I froze. What to do? Impossible to explain in a look or a gesture that I meant no offence, that they simply couldn't be in my Victorian film. There was no way to convey anything at all. I smiled at them, shrugged, nodded in a vaguely reassuring way, and went back to shooting my inserts. They never stopped watching me. Two completely different worlds passed by, each utterly inexplicable to the other. I had my finale of the entire British Army marching down the Mall in their red coats and their bearskins for the Trooping the Colour ceremony. Now all I needed was the finance. Handmade Films weren't remotely interested. Out of the blue, Joe Papp mounted a stage version of the Pirates of Penzance in the outdoor public theatre in New York's Central Park. Kevin Kline was magnificent as a very athletic pirate king, and Linda Ronstadt delightful as Mabel. 3 years ago, I got to play the Sergeant of Police on that very same stage, with Martin Short as the Major General, and Kevin Kline repeating his amazing role in a gala performance to raise money for the theatre. But this earlier version was a huge hit, and would soon move from the park to Broadway, where it would play for years. Learning of my film script, a Hollywood producer flew me in on Concorde to see it. Unfortunately, a word I came to associate with the movie business, I got shafted by the producer, who bought the Papp show. But, because I'd written my screenplay specifically for locations in the UK, he was forced to shoot his film inside a studio on a soundstage, thereby losing all the fun of a movie. A pity. No surprise, it was a total flop.
I thought that was it for Gilbert and Sullivan, but one day, out of the blue in July 1986, I got a call from Jonathan Miller. Would I be interested in playing Coco in his forthcoming production of The Mikado at the English National Opera? I hadn't foreseen becoming a diva. I asked him what on earth he was going to do with The Mikado. Well, I'm going to get rid of all that Japanese nonsense for a start. This I had to see. That's like removing the Japanese from sushi. I'm not having any of those silly knitting needles in the hair rubbish, he said. Didn't I say I adore Jonathan Miller? Of course I said yes, and soon we were rehearsing in the freezing rain of a London summer. They made a documentary of this process called A Source of Innocent Merriment, and I got to make one of my comic heroes laugh. It's on screen, too. Jonathan rolled about in hysterics when I began to grovel. Instead of Japan, Jonathan had set the production in Fredonia, the location of the Marx Brothers movie Duck Soup, and the whole design, costumes and set, was in black and white. It was a massive hit, and I was invited to repeat my role for a second season. I'd never actually seen myself as appearing in opera before, but standing on stage at the London Coliseum, with the chorus turned toward me expectantly and the orchestra sitting up and paying attention, I really enjoyed myself. It went over so well that one night a member of the orchestra said to me, "Tell me, are you Jewish or are you just very talented?" There is a tradition that the words to the Little List song can be rewritten. So each night I delivered a new set of lyrics with lines pulled straight from the headlines. The huge laughs and the sheer fun of singing live was very exciting. I got to do the Mikado again a few years later at the Houston Grand Opera, where Jonathan revealed a surprising love for sentimental Mexican songs and baseball. We were watching the World Series live from San Francisco when the screen suddenly went blank. The earthquake had hit. Fergie, still then the Duchess of York, came to the opening, and we loved Houston and made good friends there. In fact, we had such a good time that when we left Texas, Tanya was pregnant. The experience of the Mikado excited me to search for a musical to write and perform for myself. I approached Mel Brooks in Hollywood with the suggestion we appear together on stage in a musical version of The Producers, he as Bialystok, me as Bloom, directed by Jonathan Miller, who was about to take over the old Vic. Mel, though incredibly flattering about Python, was not persuaded. "I'm happy directing films," he said, not unreasonably. Many years later, at the Broadway opening of The Producers, I was very glad he'd waited, as he single-handedly revived musical comedy, and I knew that night I would now be able to find people willing to put on Spamalot. I was still searching around for a subject for a musical when I found myself in the West Indies with Mick Jagger, watching England play cricket. I was shocked to witness the News of the World, setting not one but two honey traps for Ian Botham, the team's biggest star. Mick warned him of the First Lady, but sadly he was entrapped by the second, a former Miss Barbados whom I knew, called Lindy Field, who was dropped right in it by the vultures, and the next day poor Ian Botham was faced with screaming headlines and forced to cancel his lawsuit against them. I was shocked by this blatant entrapment, and I didn't know what to do with this information, so, naturally, I wrote a musical. I created Behind the Crease with John Dupre. It was about a shoddy journalist, played by me, pursuing an English touring team in search of scandal. My former catcher, the late great Anne Howard, played Princess Joan, a slightly tipsy royal lady who had a home on the Isle of St. Jonas, where it was set. We recorded it before a live audience. It is a lot cheaper doing a musical on the radio because you don't need sets and costumes and dancing, and it was duly broadcast on BBC Radio 4. Working with John Dupre inspired me. He was the perfect partner. In 1982, I had written a lyric for The Meaning of Life, placing ourselves in the universe, a pulling back of perspective which shows how truly inconsequential we are. Just remember that you're travelling on a planet that's evolving and revolving at 900 miles an hour. I'd written a fairly simple tune for it, but when I played it to John, he said, "That's not how this song goes. This is how this song goes, and laid down a wonderful melody. The hit from Spamalot, the song that goes like this, began with John playing around with some chords while I was on my way to the bathroom. "Wait, that's it," I said, running back in and clicking on the tape machine. I began ad-libbing an overacting Broadway singer. "Once in every show, there comes a song like this that starts off soft and low and ends up with a kiss. Oh, where is the song that goes like this? Where is it? Where? We improvised the whole song. So we had done a radio musical, and for a time, London Weekend Television played with the idea of doing it on TV. But now we needed another subject. We found it in Edward Lear's poem, The Owl and the Pussycat. We adapted this as an animated movie, since we realized they were the only musicals being made by Hollywood. I pitched it to Steven Spielberg. He looked puzzled, and when he kept talking about Barbara Streisand, I realized that Americans had no knowledge at all of the Edward Lear poem. So I adapted it as a children's book for my 5-year-old daughter Lily, and we recorded the tale with 10 songs for Dove Audio as The Quite Remarkable Adventures of the Owl and the Pussycat. I even got a Grammy nomination for it, but we were no nearer our quest to make a musical. Meanwhile, I continued working as an actor. I told you bad films were more fun, and I should know. I was in quite a few. I will spare you the full list, though sadly IMDb never forgets. Burn, Hollywood, Burn won 5 awards, including Worst Picture, at the 1998 Golden Raspberry Awards, although I got nothing, not even a nomination. It was originally entitled An Alan Smithy Film, and I played the eponymous Alan Smithy, the name the Directors Guild puts on a movie when the director takes his off. Irony of ironies, then, when Arthur Hiller removed his name from the final cut, and the Alan Smithy film ended up being directed by Alan Smithy. However, it was quite fun filming with Sylvester Stallone, Ryan O'Neill, and Jackie Chan, to name drop but 3. Dudley Do-Right was filmed in a monsoon in Vancouver, and it rained so much that I turned a screenplay into a novel, The Road to Mars, in the hotel in which I was holed up for several weeks. Too Much Sun was a low-budget caper directed by Robert Downey Sr., starring his son, Robert Downey Jr. Junior was quite young and very funny. One day Senior asked him, "Robert, when do you learn your lines?" Robert replied, "Oh, usually by the 3rd take." I did, however, have a hit movie, and oddly it was funded by Dennis O'Brien. He had approached me at Cannes to make something for Handmade Films. "How appropriate," I said. "I made the first Handmade Film, now I can make the last." He looked pained, but it was. Johnny Lynn, my old friend from Cambridge, and the director of my play Pass the Butler in the West End, had written a funny script about 2 West End gangsters hiding out in a nunnery. He wanted me to play it with Michael Palin, and when Mike turned it down, I suggested Robbie Coltrane. It was a wonderful partnership. Robbie was hilarious as Sister Euphemia, while I played Sister Inviolata, and it was even fun to film. Once Robbie sat dressed as a nun, smoking a cigarette with his habit up to his knees, when a lady came up to him and asked him for spiritual advice. Oops. Nuns on the Run was a big hit in the UK and made a lot of money, but here is the magic of cinema. The movie took £3.5 million at the box office in England, and not a single penny found its way into my pocket. 2 of the distributors, whose names I have kindly removed so that their wives and children may live without shame, had been screwed by Dennis O'Brien on another deal, so they refused to turn over any money to him. We made not a cent. Maybe we made God laugh. We certainly didn't make Siskel and Ebert laugh, who pronounced our film utterly unfunny and went out of their way to abuse us in print and on television. Well, at least we had a good time. And I always thought Ebert looked like an old nun. One of the best times of the 80s was filming Passepartout alongside Pierce Brosnan's Phileas Fogg in Around the World in 80 Days, which NBC made as a miniseries in England, Hong Kong, Macau, Thailand and Yugoslavia. Pierce is a hilarious man, and we had a lot of fun.
Often Tanya and I would join him for dinner at his request, as he was literally hounded by females. They would look very disappointed as we turned up yet again. There are only two rules in show business for actors. Never appear in a Stanley Kubrick movie, and never appear in a Terry Gilliam movie. I broke this rule when Terry invited me to appear in The Adventures of Baron Munchausen, which he was shooting at Cinecittà Studios in Rome. Summer in Italy, at Fellini's studio, with further locations in Spain, what could possibly go wrong? Well, actually, everything. I shall draw a veil over 9 months of torture, but it would have taken a crate of Booker to numb the senses. Of course, there were many fine times, but how no one died, I have no idea. I would often find myself having to stand in front of Sarah Polley, the sweetest little 8-year-old girl, when things got rough. Once I was with Sarah and Jack Purvis at the back of a small boat, and directly in front of us was a stunt double on a huge white horse. Suddenly, explosions went off, the horse panicked, reared up, and began backing into us on its hind legs. I thought we were done for, but the rider, brilliantly, tugged the reins and took the horse overboard. I recently had some correspondence with Sarah, now a very fine film director, and she said she still had anxieties from those times. When she read a tweet of mine about the dangers we underwent, she wrote to me, "It was one of the only times I've had someone validate my feelings and memories of the experience of being on that set. I can't tell you how much it meant to me to read it. I'd love to hear your take on the whole experience. You were always so kind to me. I remember you creating so many moments for me to feel like a child, playing music, buying me a synthesizer, taking me on walks, making sure I stayed warm. I've always been incredibly grateful and think back often to your care for me when I really needed it. And my children know every word to just remember that you're standing on a planet." Chapter 20, Thin White Dukes. I've met many people in my life, and sadly, many of them were not famous. I agree it's not their fault, though they might have tried harder. Anyway, I'm not writing about them because you don't know who the hell they are, and I'm tired of little notes from my English or American editor saying, "Who's this?" Surely they've heard of the Queen. I believe it is wrong to be prejudiced against people just because they're not well known. Fame can bring a sad misunderstanding about the nature of life. As George Harrison never failed to point out, even the famous have to die. Although I think in America, they do suspect it gives you a pass on the death thing. Anyway, I've always tried not to hold fame against those who suffer from it. It's really not their fault that just because they possess some talent in a popular performing art, people look up to them, worship them, stalk them, hunt them down, and kill them. Fan, after all, is short for fanatic. So I try very hard not to discriminate against the illustrious and eminent. In any case, it's only after you've achieved fame that you realize that it is a piece of shit. As Bob Dylan observed, it's only really useful for getting tables in restaurants. It can be very confusing when you see people smiling at you across a room and you panic thinking, "Have I met that person? Or are they remembering me for something I did in a frock a long time ago?" So you end up hopelessly nodding at strangers in airports and saying, "Nice to see you again," to the wife. Nice to meet you is always a minefield and to be avoided, unless you can remember with some certainty that you never actually have met a pope before. America used to be about the pursuit of happiness, but they seem to have exchanged that for the pursuit of money, fame, and Twitter followers. Once you become a celebrity in today's culture, not only do people feel they have the right to bother you or shoot you or demand you pose for selfies and scribble your name on grubby bits of paper, but they get your identity wrong, confuse you with other people, tell you shows you weren't in, and then ask you what your name is. I always tell them I'm Michael Palin, and to go fuck themselves, so I can help ruin his reputation for niceness. Whenever I checked into a hotel in the 80s, I would check in as Mick Jagger. It's better to be mistaken for a better class of person, don't you think? Nowadays I don't do that. I need my sleep. And I bet so does Mick. For a while I was his Bunbury,
when he would tell Jerry he was out all night with me.
Yeah, right.
Some of his friends believed it, and David Bailey wouldn't have dinner with me because he and his model wife, Marie Helvin, thought I was leading Mick into trouble.
As if.
Eventually, Tanya cleared my good name, which was only right, since I was home every night with her. Perhaps the best way to ensure that people leave you alone is registering at hotels under the name of a novelist. Although I don't recommend Salman Rushdie for security reasons. I recommend his books, and I was rather startled to find myself entering his latest, The Golden House. Yes, me personally. It's a bit scary to be quietly reading a novel in bed and find yourself coming into the scene. I even sing Always Look on the Bright Side of Life at the dinner party in the book. I've known Salman for some years since we met at a Billy Connolly concert in Hammersmith, where his dates were four hefty guys from Special Branch. And we sat singing Beatles songs with Jerry Rafferty. You don't have to believe me, but who could make this shit up? Anyway, you can register away in hotels as Martin Amis and Ian McEwan, confident in the knowledge that people will leave you alone. I once tried registering as Meryl Streep, but then I felt guilty because she's so damn nice and smart. Notice how cleverly I introduced the fact that I know her. That's name-dropping at its finest, as I said to Prince Charles only the other day. He wasn't there, but I like to talk to myself, and if I pretend he's in the room, it feels classier. I used to talk to myself in French so that people would think I was quoting Rambo. No, not Sylvester Stallone. Nowadays, I talk to myself in a Birmingham accent, like Jeff Lynne's, because I like talking like that, and if people overhear me, they will assume I am rehearsing for some kind of Midland sitcom with Lenny Henry or an episode of Peaky Blinders. I've been pals with Jeff for a long time now, and we've played guitars and drank a lot of red wine. One night, quite late, we'd had a few, and were playing away when Jeff said, "Let's form a group." "Okay," I said. "What should we call ourselves?" "The Fuck You Two." So began a legendary duo that was dedicated to never writing, recording, or releasing anything at all, and was constantly on the brink of splitting up. The FU2 is still my favourite group. Even though I did once write Toad the Wet Sprocket in a sketch and nearly drove off the road when I heard them announced on the radio in California. They sent me a platinum record. I think Blind Lemon Pie was also borrowed from the Ruttles. "What has this to do with the price of cheese?" I hear you ask. Well, it's all by way of being a preamble to my meeting with David Bowie and how we became friends in the 80s. I wasn't particularly a Bowie fan when we met, and early on he asked me to collaborate with him in making a Ziggy musical, handing me a tape of Diamond Dogs to listen to. I didn't know how to respond, so I said, "It's very loud." Luckily, he laughed. That was the great thing about David. He would simply explode into laughter. He was surprisingly normal, and he loved comedians. He pursued comedians like he pursued musicians, like he pursued everything, really, with a high seriousness. I met him for tea in Hollywood through our mutual friend Bobcat Goldthwait, the rowdy comedian and now brilliant director, in the pink house we stayed in above Sunset. We had almost met when we were on the road in the UK in 1973. His tour went up the East Coast, while Python's went up the West, and both tours collided in Edinburgh, where we all stayed at the same hotel. There were carrot-haired weirdos at breakfast, but only Terry Gilliam was smart and hip enough to go to his show. I ran into David again in the 80s, when we were both guests of Lorne and Susan Michaels, on St. Bart's in the Caribbean. David and Coco Schwab, and his young son Joe, now Duncan Jones, the amazingly good movie director of Moon, Warcraft, and Mute, were staying with Lorne and a house party of friends. We immediately launched into North Country gay dresser chat and spent 2 days improvising camp dialogue. "Well," I said, "you're not going to wear that on stage, are you? If looks could kill, I'd have been a slab of herring. Ooh, get back in the knife box, you're too sharp to live." David was very funny, and for days we bantered interminably in these panto voices until the rest of the group became thoroughly sick of it and begged us to stop. Back home, David invited Tanya and me to visit him and Coco at their Swiss villa in Vevey. One night they took us to dinner with Una Chaplin. Here we learn the story of how, after Charlie Chaplin died and was buried locally, two Polish men had the idea of digging up and kidnapping his corpse. They called Una and demanded $2 million for the return of the body. "Keep it," said Una brilliantly. 2 days later, the body was returned. Not a brilliantly thought-out crime.